Hi, everybody. We'd love to welcome you here to Read Science. I'm Joanne, and my co-host is Jeff Schomeyer. And our guest today is Mary Roach, the New York Times bestseller of Stiff and Spook and Bonk and Packing for Mars. And her latest book is Gulp, which I hope most of you have managed to go out and get. And so this is Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. Really glad to have you here, Mary.
Oh, happy to be here. Nice to be here. Hello, everybody.
It's great. Well, that's the thing. I got to figure out how to get extra people, but not too many. I think there's a maximum of 10 you could invite. But when I've done things like this, I've had people who turned on their music, and then they're always prominent. Like whoever's making the most noise is the prominent on the screen.
Oh, is that how it works?
Yes. I think there's a way to control.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Right. There's a way I could control who's up, but yeah. So that's just more than I need to learn in the first time around, right?
It's experimental, as you said.
Yes. So I'm really excited about your book because, of course, I'm a biologist, and
yes.
Most of your books focus on biology, on human biology.
Yeah.
Did you find this one any more challenging or less so?
This one was, well, there are certain areas, I'm definitely, because I don't have a background in biology, I'm a little limited in what I can really delve into. So I'm, there was at one point where I thought, oh, maybe I'll explore the mind-gut connection. And so I downloaded a 40-page paper and I thought, this is just way beyond what I can process and turn into something that fits in this book. So there were a couple areas that were, a little challenging for someone like me.
That you weren't quite ready to delve into. So your book follows sort of down the alimentary canal from your mouth all the way to the end.
So, nose to tail.
Yep, nose to tail. So what would you say was your, the most, I don't know, let's start with the most interesting as far as the people you met and the information
right.
you discovered?
Well, I always find it fascinating to discover that there are entire fields of science that I've never heard of, like the science of oral processing, that there's people who study bolus formation in the mouth and the physics of chewing and saliva. I spent a day with a woman who in the Netherlands, and a beautiful Italian woman. What she does is study saliva, and so I find it fascinating because they take you to a whole other level with regard to the subject matter. But also, I just love spending time with somebody who's made their life's work something that most of us just take completely for granted and don't give any thought to. So it was kind of so that in itself was was pretty interesting and surprising.
And it is great. That's one of my favorite things is to talk to people, you know, who've discovered their passion and have made new discoveries because of that.
Right, right. Especially when it's something like saliva, you know, if somebody's passion is spit.
It was a good chapter, actually. I remember that one. I remember them all.
Physical scientists are like that. I'm a physical scientist, and you just... It's pretty unpredictable sometimes what will turn people on and go, oh, wow, cool, we can measure the viscosity of spit.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Since Mary brought it up, and I had read elsewhere, and thinking about, I just finished reading Bonk, which I enjoyed very much, thank you, and I've also read Spook and Stiff back when they were newer. But you told somebody that humanity or human topics were a theme of yours, and whether that's, it does seem to be true. And the question that came to mind for me was whether that was something that you started out with or whether that was a theme that, you know, you looked back and said, oh, I keep choosing these human things. And along with that, when I was reading Bonk, I thought, is it really the frequent absurdity of the human condition that attracts you to
yes.
so many good stories to tell?
Yeah, I think it is the absurdity and the surrealness sometimes of the human condition, and the fact that, you know, we are ultimately just animals like any other animal. We're digesting and excreting and mating, but we try very hard to think of ourselves as something higher and loftier. We tend to think of ourselves as personalities and minds, and then, but we can't escape the fact that we're these biological creatures, and I guess that's part of what I find fascinating. And I'm also the reason, I guess part of the reason I cover the things that I do cover is I like to be, you know, I'm a little bit antiquated when it comes to science. A lot of science today is going on a not just microscopic but molecular genomic level. So that's not stuff you can go to a lab and see people doing things. I mean, you can see them doing things, but a lot of it's taking place in beneath the microscope or even invisibly. You can't really share it with the reader in the same way that you can somebody who's in a lab chewing on a plug to absorb spit and then centrifuging the plug to get the saliva out and then, you know, taking it when taking a pipette and actually doing science as I was taught it as a kid. So I'm kind of I'm inhabiting a world of science that is a little bit rare these days.
You're writing for non-scientists who have right. a whole world to catch up on that they don't know about that yeah. is microscopic and takes place on the laptop and things.
Right.
And old science is fine with me because my yeah. field that I was researching was all thermodynamics, which the modern kids all think of as terribly white-haired and old-fashioned. But there are so many good stories already to tell about things that people don't know about, and this yeah. is a theme that Joanne and I will touch on, is inviting people to find out about science, and there's plenty of stories there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think of myself, I guess in some sense I'm sort of a gateway drug to yeah. science. And hopefully not leading people astray, like saying, look how fascinating science is, and then they decide to major in it. But I think that once the further that you go with science, you know, you become fascinated on that deeper level, on that molecular level, and you know that fascination will stay with you, hopefully.
That's exactly right, and at least one of my things. But Joanne hears this from me all the time, is any story is interesting that attracts people's attention, and then you know, so tell that story. But the vital thing is, don't mistell the science. Don't say something wrong or misleading or
right.
stupid. You know, try to include the science as a cultural aspect, as a natural part of the story. But please, 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 pay some attention to getting it right. And
yeah,
it may not go without saying that we're talking to you because, thankfully, you tell these interesting stories, but you get the science right. And I think that's that's the way it should be, and that's
yeah.
very commendable too. But I think that does a very valuable service for non-scientists.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that because you sometimes there's two sides to the debate. There are people who feel that it trivializes, that humor trivializes the science, or that it I try very hard to get it accurate, but I am presenting a fairly simple view of whatever it is. Because of the nature of the books and the audience that they're for, but. Yeah, but it's very nice to hear that from you. Yeah.
Sure. Well, attracting their attention and fostering their interest without selling them snake oil is
right.
a great thing.
Yeah.
And,
right.
and it does that.
So do you have, I would assume the answer is going to just be yes, but maybe describe, you ever have a troll who comes and said, well, you just presented this all wrong, and or do you do okay because you go right to the the specialist in spit, right? So if you're to her, then you know you're getting it right. Or do you have someone who insists on saying, well, you know, you should
have
done it
this way? You mean somebody that I've gone to interview, you mean?
No, but maybe someone who's read your book and then decided to come tell you how you got something wrong.
Very, very rarely.
Good.
Yeah. And usually when people write to me, usually when I have something wrong, it's some nugget of military history or I'm trying to think of things, or the fact that the person jogging in 2001 is not Keir DeLay, it's Gary Lockwood. So it's more often that kind of thing than you got this all wrong. I think because I'm reporting such very finely focused episodes of science, and I'm not trying to take on all of digestion or even how the stomach works. It's I get caught up in like, wow, could could someone survive, you know, as a way to talk about the stomach, I looked at, you know, could someone survive, like Jonah, and then I went further on, like, could anybody,
yeah.
Sorry, let me just get that.
That's fine.
Hello. Sorry, I'm doing a Google Hangout, I have to go. 90. Okay.
That's awesome.
Sorry.
That's fine.
Sorry.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so sorry about that. That's my husband saying, how much do we pay the cleaning lady? where was I? I'm usually, the Jonah, and then I was wondering, is there any creature that could survive, which got me to that wonderful historical chapter, historical discussion of stomach snakes and frogs, and the belief that people had that there was something living inside them, that they really believed that because they didn't know what was going on. They interpreted the feelings of the normal motions of the digestive tract as there's something living in me. And then I took that further to that rumor on the internet that mealworms can eat their way out of the stomach of a lizard. So, you know, because I'm on this little narrow road, it's pretty easy to get things right. So, I'm not covering a topic very, very broadly and trying to, I think I couldn't, I would really need to have a background in science, in whatever science that was. So, but I do from time to time get somebody saying, you know, you're contributing to scientific illiteracy by not explaining things thoroughly or whatever. You know, you get every now and then someone who needs a hug.
That's a good way to put it. Now, I'm an advocate. Well, both Jeff and I are just like getting people interested in science. And of course, I like accuracy, but I love your books. And I think, you know, they serve a wonderful purpose. You know, you're a bestseller, right? You've sold so many books. You do better than a lot of the science writers out there. So because you have the humor and because you come to it from a viewpoint of someone who wants to know as well.
Right.
So I like how you discussed, what happens to chewing gum. Yeah, it goes all the way through, folks.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? If nothing else, people know this, or maybe that watermelon is not going to grow in your stomach if you swallow a seed. When all is said and done.
What's
there.
If you tell the stories with some precision and accuracy, but make them interesting. Don't get wrong. Whatever comes up, and don't try too hard to keep the science out of the way, because that might terrify people. I can't see. I think it's all to the good.
Yeah, I mean, I try to use the narrative framework, sort of to have a scaffolding or just a frame to hang the facts that, so that people will, you know, they'll come into their minds in the context of a story, which I think makes it easier to learn, or a more appealing way to learn something, to have it in a broader story, as
now,
it were.
Yeah. While we're sort of close to that, I had another question written down that everybody who writes about your books talks about, says, she does this with great humor and things, which is, I think, is a nice thing to say about people. It's good to have a light touch and not be as dull as scientists sometimes can be. But there's a difference between, I can imagine a difference between telling things as a series of jokes and simply finding good and interesting and cultural and illuminating stories that are just absurd.
Yeah, right.
When you
talk
about them. And I think that's a lot of where that comes from. And do you plan that? Does that just happen? Do you use your intuition? Do you have some rules now about how to handle the so-called humor aspect?
You're absolutely right. It's not, the humor in the books is not generated by me trying to be like a comic. I'm not generating lines, every now and then, but it's much more, I'm looking for situations that are going to be somewhat absurd or surreal. For example, you know, putting myself, and sometimes it's just the vast gap between my knowledge and the knowledge of, like, there's in Spook, there's this guy. He studies consciousness theory, and he's just going, and he's speaking in a very, very advanced degree kind of way, and I'm struggling to understand, you know, quantum mechanics, basically. And the humor in that chapter comes from the two of us trying to actually have a conversation. And it's one of my favorite chapters, and one of the, it was, you know, I was just struggling to just present it in a way that I wouldn't completely lose people with the science, but also I wanted them to understand the basic principles. It was the soul weighing chapter, and he was sort of a modern day Duncan McDougall, the guy who tried to put dying people on a scale. But anyway, so yeah, it's the situation of kind of the absurdities of being these biological creatures and studying them, and of course Bonk was full of that kind of situation, because you're bringing human beings into a lab and having them be sexual and trying to study that, and that's of course so awkward.
It's that, almost all absurd.
Yeah, exactly, right. So very much that I'm consciously looking for situations that, and I never know till I get there, but I'm looking for situations where the humor, I don't want it at the expense of the scientist. I don't want it at the expense of the science. Just the juxtaposition of science and spit or whatever it is, the humor comes from, it's a subtle humor. It's not like yuck kind of guffaw humor, really. Yeah.
Let me revisit a question I asked you a few years back. So I'll preface all of this saying I drove 5 hours to meet Mary Roach and hang out with her all day at a biomechanics symposium. And actually, before I go on to revisit the question, I learned from you, Mary, the most interesting thing that, you know, I hold on to this day when I'm communicating, is we were sitting there and we were watching a graduate student, probably at her very first symposium, presenting her research, and she's going and going and going, and you lean over and you go, "This is a little dry, isn't it?" And I thought, and I stopped and I went, "Yeah, I guess it is." And then I realized us science people are made of really tough stuff. Because we don't care how you're dressed. We don't care if it's amusing. We don't care if it's engaging. We're just sitting there going, we're going to grab this material and analyze it based solely on the material.
Right.
So we're not trying to always engage and entertain.
Right.
And so I was like, oh, wow. We, you know, I just held on to that since.
Yeah. But you shouldn't have to, as scientists, entertain. You know,
right.
It's enough of a burden to do the research, to do it well and present it to a group. I don't think anybody should feel obligated to have snazzy slides or be witty and entertaining. I just think that's way more than any scientist has time for or, you know, should have to worry about, you know.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, that was a fun day, and at the end of it, I did interview you, and I remember I had asked if people would turn in questions, and one question came from Carl Zimmer, and his question was, is there anything you cannot make funny in science? And I remember your answer were things that were broader and over a long time scale or very specific, like molecular biology or maybe the weather or maybe geology. Do you still find that to be true?
Very much. I think Jeff really hit the nail on the head when he said it's the human condition, the science of the human condition. Whether even Packing for Mars is really a book about this sort of surreal challenges of taking an organism that evolved in Earth gravity and trying to make it function in zero gravity where nothing works right. And all of the shenanigans and plannings and reconfiguring that goes on toward that goal is fascinating. So it is... So that's really where where I'm focused and where most of the humor comes from. So I would say most of science I couldn't make it funny. Astronomy doesn't strike me as particularly funny. Physics, because it's so abstract, and someone like me, there's humor in someone like me trying to understand it and present it, but. And anything in genetics would be, well, genetics has some really surreal stuff going on now. So I think, you know, there could be some fun to be had there, but you know, you don't want it to be forced. That's the other thing.
But I think you have found a good secret for how to do this with your interest in human stories, is that microbiology, it may be hard to make it entertaining or something, but stories about microbiologists trying to do microbiology, especially when it sounds like some stupid topic, can be very entertaining, and scientists, for no little reason, have a reputation for being eccentric, and you can make that into good stories, and that conveys the science along with it.
Yeah, very much so. Oh, microbiology can be very fun. Microbiology is, I think microbiology, well, yeah, and people are fascinated with particularly the human microbiome, this notion that they have inside them, this whole community, this whole universe of little creatures. I think it's a topic, I know, and Carl does such a beautiful job with it. And I always admire, I mean, Carl has he's got a very devoted following, and he doesn't necessarily have to make it funny. You know, he just makes it real and makes it fascinating. I mean, I am in awe of people who can write books without sort of, I mean, I don't, not with the crutch of humor, but it's how I do it. But if I didn't have that, I think that my books would fall flat. I don't think they would do very well.
Maybe not. It seems like either... humor or enthusiasm seem to be the vital component.
Definitely.
Yeah. Well, there was a question that was coming on right at the end of that, and I've forgotten it.
Oh.
Yes. And I'm sure it was the best question of the whole day.
It'll come back.
Yeah.
Just let it go. Set it aside. It'll come back.
Don't you think?
Like Mary's little lamb.
Yeah,
come home.
You know, you're saying, well, I can't do this because I'm not a scientist, and this I work. But do you really worry about not being a scientist? Is it part of what you do here, and part of the natural humor, the understanding, and conveying enthusiasm and information? The fact that you're not a scientist and things look absurd to you that would not look absurd maybe to me and Joanne.
Yes, that's true. That's true. I don't think I could do. I couldn't write the books that I write if I had a background. And I notice even from the time I begin a project when I've been in it for a year or so, and it starts to seem more normal, and it does, like the humor, things that would have struck me as funny maybe at the beginning or strange or surprising, you know, I'm starting already to, you know, be used to the material. So it is the newness of it and the surprises that I encounter when I'm first stepping into that world. That's where a lot of the humor and surprise comes from. So I couldn't do what I do without being ignorant.
Yeah. We read a lot about your raised eyebrows in these encounters that you describe. In that process, it was a sort of technical note, but in that process, as you're doing research, there's sort of two questions I'm interested in. One is, how much do you start out knowing that you want to do address a particular type of research, you know, talk to the people who use the test tubes to do particular things, for instance, and how much of it comes along while you're doing that, and then...
Yeah.
As you're doing the research, where in there do you start to feel that your table of contents, your series of topics, starts to become something you can work with?
Yeah, that's a great question. I start out, I have an idea, a very broad idea of what I might cover in a book, and I almost always stray from that, because when I realize what's really out there and how this science works and what the possibilities are, I realize that the things I had imagined exist either don't exist or they're not that interesting. So I'm as I go along, every new lab I go to, I'll learn about someone else or something else. So it's very much evolving. Over the first 6 months, I'd say, I'm constantly jettisoning, oh, I thought I was going to do this, and now I'm not. So there's always five or six folders in my file cabinet of things, dead ends. I thought I was going to go pursue that, but it turned out there's something more interesting or more relevant. And it's not that for at least 6 months or more, I don't have the outline, the table of contents, but I'd say around, that's about the span of time where I start to realize, okay, I think I have a sense of the lay of the land and where I'm going to go and how that will fit with where I've been and what that, you know, what the table of contents will be. And that's a very comforting knowledge to know, you know, this is what I have left to fill in and this is what I've done. But I don't have that at the beginning at all.
You know your process now, so you can be more confident about that. But you start out by following your nose,
and
the shape comes along from what you find, right?
Yeah, which would it makes it tough if it's somebody's first book and they want to present a very thorough book proposal. My book proposal for Stiff, my first book, I'd say at least half the things in that book proposal are not in the final book because I was writing from absolute ignorance, just having poked around a little bit on the internet and done a couple of stories in the past that related. So I had a very sketchy sense of what was out there in the world. So I ended up, but fortunately editors don't take your proposal and compare it side by side with your book when you're done.
So when you're actually writing, so I'm not a writer and you won't catch me honing my skills as a writer at any time. I mean, I write sufficiently. I do what I need to do. But so do you find yourself that you have to block off a certain amount of time to write? Or do you just sort of like, oh, I just, you know, I talked to her. This was fabulous. And you're sitting in your hotel room at night just writing?
No, I don't start to write until I have all the material I would need for a chapter. So even if I've gone to interview somebody, spend time with them in the field, I wouldn't until I have the, because there's typically a lot of other research background or some historical that has to be done. So until I have all of that, I don't start writing. So and when I do, as soon as I have everything I think I need, then I do start to write because I don't like it to get too stale if I can avoid it. So it's when the material's ready to be written, that's when I start writing it.
And I assume you'll have overlap. You'll be visiting one expert and while you're trying to still research on that, and then you'll have to zip over to someone else's lab and interact there.
I'm always doing research at the same time as I'm writing, and a lot of what I end up doing is emailing strangers and trying to insert myself into their busy life and let them know what I'm doing and hope that they'll have something interesting coming up in the next 6 months that I could come and see or be involved in. So that a lot of my time is just pestering scientists.
Well, this must be so much easier now that you have several books under your belt, right?
Yeah.
Than I can imagine when you first wrote Stiff.
Yes, definitely. It's nice to get somebody to go, oh, I've read one of your books, and sure, I would love to have you come here. That's so much easier than, what are you doing, and what kind of book is that about cadavers?
Yes.
Yeah.
And so you feel like each chapter comes at about the time when you have a story of discovery to present more than when you've finally reached an understanding of something, and that's what keeps it fresh for you.
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, I have all the pieces for that chapter.
Right.
And sometimes that I don't exactly know where it will fit in the book. Usually I have a pretty good sense, but sometimes it may get shifted around, but that's okay. I want to write it while it's relatively fresh.
What do you think makes the, and I don't want this to be a, you know, where do your book ideas come from, but chapters or books, what do you think provokes your ideas or plants the seeds or something? Is it an anecdote? Is there a fact that comes along? And I'm sure it's going to be a mixture, but what catches your interest and becomes something that you can turn into something bigger and that's still interesting?
Well, the example that answers the question in a way that doesn't apply to every book is Bonk, which was really a situation where there was one moment where I read a sentence in Film Quarterly, of all things, and it was about Masters and Johnson and the films that they made. Yes, bonk. Thank you. A little visual aid.
Yes.
So they talked about the colposcopic films of Masters and Johnson. And I went, colposcopic? Is that mean like cervix? What is that? Is that some sort of internal movie that? And I looked them up because I thought, really? And in fact, they did films with a camera in a phallus that women would have come in and have intercourse with. And it was at that moment that I learned that. I thought, duh, sex research. That's my next book. It was just, boom, I know. And I know that I knew that my publisher would be delighted. I knew it wouldn't be a problem to sell this book. So it was one sentence in a journal. Not a medical journal, even. So sometimes it's easy like that. Other times I have a cluster of things that I think would be fun to write about, and I think, well, what would be the umbrella topic? Like Gulp was a situation where I had a few things that over the years I'd had fun with but couldn't really explore very much for the magazine piece. So I kind of looked at those and thought, oh, well, this is kind of an obvious Mary Roach territory. I don't know why I never thought of covering the whole alimentary canal. So that was really just, well, I'd like to write about that and that and that and what encompasses these. Oh, okay. Yeah, so that, yeah.
So now, given Jeff and I had run our Kids Read Science and Teen Read Science contest a few years back and sort of took our theme of our hangouts here, Read Science, I would like to ask, if you wouldn't mind sharing, like, what did you read when you were young?
Sure.
Was any of it science at all, or did you were just reading?
I loved Tintin, those, which I guess were the early graphic novels. Tintin, I loved Harriet the Spy. I loved the Black Stallion series, the Narnia books. I'm trying to think if there was any science. I got Weekly Reader, which I don't know if there was much science in Weekly Reader. As a little kid, I was in that was like fourth grade.
It's for inquiring minds.
And yeah. Highlights for children.
Yeah.
I don't know that there was, I don't think that the genre of kids' science books was as rich as it is now. I don't, maybe I'm wrong. Do you remember a lot of?
I was going to say, when I was young, even as a teen, if I wanted science, it was Scientific American. I mean, you're going to get that from, you know, a prescription, a subscription. Everything should be prescribed scientifically.
Yeah, it almost was a prescription.
But now, you know, even when I was raising my kids and still raising, but like even for very young kids, there are these amazing books about science. That, you know, it's just, it's great. So what
we did have them. We had series of Time Life books, I can remember.
That's
being
right.
For instance.
That's right.
And they did a spectacularly good job. And I think there's always been something, but they tend to be hidden.
You know what I read? Because my parents got Reader's Digest, there was this series, I Am Joe's colon, I Am Jane's, I Am Jane, and it was a big deal when they did I Am Jane's ovary, I Am Jane's breast.
Wow.
That was like, it was like 10 years into the series when they finally get their nerve up to do Jane's breast because it might be pornographic. But those, I remember sitting, you know, because it was always in the bathrooms. I would always read the I Am Joe's heart or whatever it was. So I think that is something I remember, the Reader's Digest series, I Am Joe's Brain.
That's good. You've given me a great lead-in for a couple questions that I had written down. And as so you know that I was reading Bonk. And there were a couple of things. I was in your in the introduction very early before you answered the question, and I'm thinking, I'm wondering how you settled on what kind of vocabulary you were going to use to describe the sex research and all of this. And then you said, well, you used the Lily and Phoebe test. And it's like, so then part of the question is, did that really take care of it? It's a good story, but is that where you did it? And then the other part is, now that you've gotten to the end of that book, do you feel differently about talking about some of these things now that you've written about them and gone on tours and things? That's a transformative experience, and I say that from experience from some of the things that I write about.
Yeah.
Knows, but I do fiction. But the things that you write about give you an experience that changes you.
Yeah.
Write your books.
Yeah. Well, to answer the second part first, if you spend a few weeks on the road talking, well, even before I went on the book tour, just having to be interviewing people who research sexual physiology, you are constantly saying orgasm, clitoris, vagina, masturbation. You say it so much that the electrical charge disappears from those words,
yeah.
And it's like talking about polishing the silver. Really, it's not, or anything. It just becomes, and because it long ago these words ceased to have any charge to them for the researchers, they're very comfortable talking about it, so you become comfortable. And then in turn, I think your audience starts to become, you talk to a group of strangers about sex, and there's something kind of liberating for them. You find, the first person's a little shy to raise their hand, and then once one person asks a fairly explicit sexual physiology question, a lot of hands go up, and it's sort of, I think people feel kind of freed to say things that they didn't have a setting in which to say them before. So it came naturally over the course of writing the book. The first part of your question, though, what words to use, was tough because, I think I used the word bonk once in the book. I don't use a lot of slang in the book, not because I'm anti-slang, but I just, my only concern is that there are not a lot of synonyms. There are not a lot of other ways to say penis.
Don't you think a lot is served by using a straightforward language?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I much prefer to use straightforward language than not even a euphemism, but sort of just for variety's sake, I wanted to mix it up a little bit to stop saying the same word over and over, but there's not a lot of good choices, and I didn't want something, a romance novel euphemism would be horrible or dreadful. And I didn't want a lot of, street talk either.
Right.
Wasn't really appropriate. So there's a lot of just the actual word itself. And one of the things I love in science is the terminology. Like some of the words, like borborygmi, I learned this word for gulp, which has to do with, that's the the sounds of rumblings of the intestines, borborygmi.
Yeah.
I love that word, and just the fact that somebody came up with a word for this biological phenomenon is one I love. I'm always enchanted by that.
I have a story I'm working on where a book where I will use the word. So I wanted to thank you particularly for teaching me the word télé clitoridienne.
Define that for the audience.
It's in the book, and if you look it up,
in bonk,
it has to do with the difference, the distance between the clitoris and what was the particular measure from?
Well, it's essentially the clitoris to the opening of the vagina, but she used I think she might use the urethra for some reason, but she was trying to get at some women have a. Their clitoris is very close to the opening of to the vagina, and others it's very distant. Yeah.
And she had. Oh, this is Mrs. Bonaparte, who had the theory that was basically seemed to be correct, that how likely it was for the woman to be stimulated at the clitoris during vaginal sex had a lot to do with whether she had an orgasm and her pleasure. Finishing up this idea for me, when you talk to people about not just bonk, but some of your other topics come at least close to some taboo sorts of things.
Yes.
Researching on dead people and things is a little queasy for some people.
Yeah.
Do you get feedback that tells you people are finding it sort of a refreshing release that you're letting them in on things that were mysteries before and now they can understand and that makes them less mysterious and that you also give them leave to talk about some of these things
that
they need an excuse to talk about.
I do get that feedback from time to time. And Stiff in particular, when that book came out, I was concerned. I didn't want, because there's humor in the book, and it is a book that deals with dead bodies and therefore death, even though it's not a book about death per se, or loss or grieving, it's a book about what happens. It's post-mortem careers is more what the book's about. I worried that the humor might offend some people or make them, offend them. But I've received a fair number, probably 10 at least, letters, emails from people saying that it was strangely comforting to have somebody talk in a straightforward way about what happens to the body at death. And by demystifying it, anytime you can demystify something that's sort of kept behind closed doors, it gives some, it's almost like getting closure by getting the remains of a loved one. It's hard to say why that has that effect, but just giving people some facts is a very comforting thing, and it gives them permission. They then can talk about it comfortably, and so that's been gratifying to hear from people who have been reading the book sometimes or when around the time they lost someone. And that's what I was worried about, that someone would pick this book up and have just had an experience with the death of someone they love and found the book to be upsetting, and I didn't want that. And so it's been great when somebody's had the opposite experience with it.
Great. So part of our show here is to mention some books we personally are reading. I know you're very busy, but are you reading something right now? Or, I'm going to read you, I promise.
I just read a wonderful book that comes out in May by John Mualim, he's called a science writer. He doesn't think of himself, he just thinks of himself as a writer who sometimes writes about things in the realm of science and nature. But he's written this beautiful book called Wild Ones, which has to do with the history and science of endangered species and how we decide what to protect, how to protect, why, which ones, and just a lovely, I mean, he's just a beautiful writer, and so that's a wonderful, that's coming out in May, and I really enjoyed that. I read it because I blurbed it, and I'm currently reading a book that's coming. I'm always blurbing, but I have to blurb. So I just started reading a book about behind the scenes in the world of shipping, which is a very kind of sort of secret, it's going on everywhere. Everything in our lives is shipped from, there's all the, going from place to place around the world. It's this sort of humming network that we don't really think about. And I love that. Anytime somebody pulls back the curtain on a little secret world, it's fascinating. So that's a really interesting book. It's called 90% of Everything.
Oh, wow.
As in 90% of everything we have is shipped. And it's by Rose George, who wrote that book on,
I just put an article up on Scientific American about India drowning in its own excrement. Because I got to visit India with the International Reporting Project. And she also just recently came out with a TED Talk, so I thought, perfect, because I read that book, The Big Necessity, before I went to India, because I wanted to know. I wanted to be informed on the sanitary conditions. And so it's very important. So I'm glad to hear this would be her third book, wouldn't it?
She wrote one on refugee camps.
Yeah, so then this about shipping.
Exciting. It's lovely. It's a wonderful book. She's a beautiful writer. I'm trying to think what else am I reading? Well, those are the two. I'm reading a book by Charlie Wilkins, who's a Canadian writer who, he's now 60, he's 60-something, and he participated, and it was an attempt to break the record for rowing across the Atlantic, and he was he's a very funny, gifted writer, and he was well out of his league. I mean, he was in really great shape for himself, but there were former Olympic rowers, and just a grueling experience. But that book, when does that come? And of course, I'm forgetting what the name of it is. But anyway, I'm reading that too. I think it comes out in the fall.
Okay, so that's a ways out. So that's so exciting. So, I'm looking at things like that. These books that cover one topic and then open different facets about that topic, I look at like Simon Winchester did that with Krakatoa. And then that just opened the door for everybody to start doing this to my delight.
Yes.
And I just finished a book by Dan Fagan called Tom's River. It's like Science and Salvation. And it was about the Ciba Geigy moving into New Jersey and what they decided to do with their chemical waste. So it was the process of chemistry and how you make dyes, and then how does a corporation deal with all the waste?
Yeah,
and
right.
How does that impact? But then also how it sort of looks into the epidemiology. How do we know something causes cancer? Can we know?
Right.
What are
right.
the statistics of disease? And, you know, I finished that one just recently, and I really, really enjoyed it. I'm reading or listening on audio to a book called Rabid, which looks at every single thing about rabies, is very, the history and everything, the way these books do these days.
Right.
And it's very, very interesting. So I'm hoping, you know, as this Hangout project continues, I get to talk to a lot more authors and excited.
Did you ever read that book, The Fruit Hunters, by Adam Gallner? That's one of those books that, I mean, you take something, I mean, fruit doesn't sound like an inherently gripping topic, but that is the most magical book. I mean, it's one of those books where, you know, he steps into the world of people who travel to these, you know, corners of the globe trying to, you know, they're basically collectors of weird fruit and also the breeding of fruit. And I mean, there's nothing I can say that's going to get across how unbelievably gripping, magical that book is. It's just such an interesting, he's such a wonderful writer, and he has almost this, just is this childlike wonder, and this, he just falls into this world and is swept away and goes in so many different directions. And it's, I wanted that book to just be a huge, it's one of those things where you want to tell people, I know it's about fruit. I know you think this is going to be dull. But it's so interesting. So
It down now. I've written all your suggestions down because, well, I'm always on the lookout for interesting and fun, and you know, your reading helps inform you what to write, how to write.
I also love the book Cold by Strieve. Is his last name Strieve? He's a biologist and he's up in Alaska. But it just takes the topic cold and. You know, he talked about historically about the quest for absolute zero, and the people were like blowing themselves up in pursuit of this, and then all this stuff about this, you know, the subnevian world of like creatures that live not underground, not above the ground, but like in the grasses and in the frozen kind of detritus that's sort of just below the surface. Just the word cold, you know, whatever, I think he sort of free associated in it, and whatever came
he
to yeah, he, so it's very wide ranging, but it's just, again, everything, you learn so much, and it's such fascinating material. That book is, it was wonderful. Yeah.
I've got this written down. I think I've seen that one though, actually. I don't think I've read it.
There,
you know, because there's books out there like on salt and ice and skin.
Cod.
Yeah. So but that you could tell a historical tale, you can tell a scientific tale, cultural tale.
Yeah, and it's interesting, by limiting yourself, in some ways you open a lot of doors. I find I'm more comfortable. I mean, I would think it'd be an interesting exercise if somebody give you what seems to be a very narrow topic, and then just see how far, by digging in and following different tangents, how far you could go and the places it would take you that you would never expect to go, having that starting point.
Three very memorable ones from recent years. I read one about moss that was all very, a woman who had it was a very poetic but informative book. One about rats, who was a
Robert Sullivan, right?
Rats.
Journal in an alley in New York, and it just expanded. And another one is, by you know, a Facebook friend, his book on the Beaufort scale.
Oh, that's
Scott
Hewler.
Scott Hewler.
He's going to be a guest on here.
Yes, is an amazing work. It is informative and poetic, and that's what it's about. But it's one you pick up, say, I cannot believe he wrote a book about the Beaufort scale.
Yeah. I mean, or that one, I didn't read this, but Longitude, I just thought, how brilliant to, I mean, you look at globes and maps and you see these lines, but whoever had the idea to write a book about them.
Well, Joanne knows I'm a big fan of the longitude problem, so it's
that's Davis Sobel, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So, yeah.
Oh, it's so exciting. This is great. Mary, I want to thank you so much for taking time and spending time with us, almost an hour of your time.
You're welcome. It was fun, and I love the enthusiasm you guys have for bringing science to people that don't necessarily encounter it in their day-to-day lives and who may not realize that they like science. You know, that's what it's all about.
That's what I always say about my website. I said, well, it seems to be for young people, but also for older people who maybe forgot they like science.
Yeah.
Somewhere. But and I think on top of it that Jeff and I are just such strong advocates for literacy in general, but also science literacy, that science is a great way to improve your skills. And, you know, and I even think when I look at, you know, if you want to become a scientist, even if you don't, but if you want to become a scientist, what do you do most of the time? You read. You need that attention span. You need all those great things you get from reading. So,
yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And so I'm going to say right now, actually, Mary Roach will be in Chicago on Monday evening at the Harold Washington Library with Rebecca Skloot, who wrote The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. They will both be on stage.
Yeah.
And I will be in the audience trying not to be too geeky about the whole thing. Just so excited because it's a great character.
Yeah, I'm excited, very excited too. She's that book is extraordinary.
Yeah, definitely. So have you guys sat down and talked before then?
I have met her when she was in San Francisco a while back for the book tour. I met her and we just talked on the phone about this event and what we'll do. So
good. I'm looking forward to it. I plan on being there unless for some reason the Midwest has a snowstorm because it wants to. But otherwise, I'll drive up. It's not quite 5 hours, but
good. I think it's terrible about that.
Oh, don't feel terrible.
I should drive 5 hours.
Drive 5 hours there and 5 hours back, but I got to spend all day with you. And you know, in my mind, I imagine that you would just have people crawling all over you, begging to be sitting next to you. I mean, you did. You had people come up and say things and say really nice things, but I was just like, I'm hanging out with Mary Roach.
Funny. And who was there? Was another convention? Was it the Coast Guard or preparedness or
Ohio Tactical Officers?
That's right.
I remember that. So there's all these guys in their military gear. And how many parties did we get invited to, Mary? I don't know.
Oh, it's all a blur.
But it was a great time. I'm really glad I did. I mean, you know, because I made a short list of people I wanted to meet. And you were on that list. Alan Alda's on that list. And I think you and Alan actually have similarity because when Alan talks to scientists, he's going to sit there and talk to them till he understands.
Wait, Alan Alda?
Yeah, so he did a TV show a while ago called...
The guy from MASH?
Yeah, but he did a TV show a while ago called Scientific American Frontiers. It's no longer on.
Wow.
But his job as that host was to go to labs and be his enthusiastic self, an intelligent self, but a non-scientist who's sitting there saying, explain this to me. And then he felt like when he finally understood it, that there was material in that the general public could understand.
Right.
And that was the whole premise of the show. And so he's one of my heroes for actually doing that. And I see you do the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just, you know, in a narrow focus for one book. Very fascinating material. But you're in there with the scientists saying, you know, I'm here till I understand what you're doing.
Those poor people, I often say I use them like unpaid tutors. Okay, let's sit down. We're going to talk about cosmic radiation, and I don't know anything. I don't get it.
I wonder if to write that on a scientific grant when you're requesting, you know, money. I was in Mary Roach's book, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, great. You know, here's...
I survived Mary Roach.
It's hardly an unpaid gig because they sit working in their laboratories and they get the satisfaction of their work, but they really secretly are hoping that someone, anyone, will come and ask them, tell me something interesting.
Yeah.
That's right. And I mean, you know, because I don't know that being in your book, the publicity from that amounts to anything in a scientific endeavor. It makes their university very proud. Yeah, you know, right. But I think, you know, they're just probably thrilled to talk about their work, and I expect that's what you find.
Yeah, that's right.
They wouldn't invite you in.
Because their spouse is not interested. The kids don't want to hear about
it. Not anymore.
Yeah.
Okay. So there we go. I can say thank you now. Thank you very much, Mary.
Oh, thank you, Jeff. It's great to meet you.
Thank you, Mary, and I'll see you Monday.
All right, I'll see you Monday.
Okay.
All right.
Bye. And thanks to everybody out there who watched all or part of this. And if you want to rewatch it, it will be on one of my YouTube channels, whatever one that Google Plus said is connected. So I think it's Joanne Moss 7 is the one that it's on. But I'll put the link on all my social media. You can find it there. Jeff, as always, it's so wonderful to hang out with you.
It's been fun. We've finally gotten things off to a great start with Mary, and I'm looking forward to more of these conversations.
Yes, in fact, there's one this Saturday at 4 p.m. Central, and that is with Brian Switek, who wrote My Beloved Brontosaurus, and with Daniel Loxton, who has Pterosaur Trouble, which is a children's book about pterosaurs that he illustrated and wrote himself. He also has other books. So we'll be talking to two dinosaur fans who share their love with the general public. And I can't wait for that one.
I think, and then this is probably about where we sign off by saying something like, you know, goodbye from me and Joanne. Remember, read science.
That's right. Remember to read science. All right. Take care, everybody. All right. See you later, Jeff.
Okay. Bye, Joanne.